Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Wake up to a delicious morning with your favorite McDonald's breakfast sandwiches, now just $2, only in the app. Choose from a bacon, egg, and cheese biscuit, sausage McMuffin, or bacon, egg, and cheese McGriddles, just $2, only in the app. That's a deal as irresistible as the sandwiches themselves. Plus, you'll save time by ordering ahead in the app. Offer valid one time per day from July 29th through September 1st at participating McDonald's. Must opt in to rewards.
You're listening to Castrol CarCast on Podcast One.
Hey guys, before we get started with Alistair Weaver in the studio, I want to tell you about Dodge. See your authorized Dodge dealer and experience a world of performance, design, and fuel efficiency. Schedule a test drive today. Go to Dodge.com and check out our powerful lineup. Guys, welcome to Castrol CarCast. I'm Matt, the moderator, DeAndrea, and Goldberg will be missing in action today. However, we've got the great Alistair Weaver from Edmunds.com back into the studio for our monthly segment. We're going for like every third week of the month, but
monthly-ish.
It's once a month. Maybe it's not always exactly when we say it's going to be, but. Man, thanks for coming back. How are you?
No worries. I'm good. Thanks. I think we're both spending too much time on the road. That's the problem.
You've been traveling like a maniac, that's for sure, but doing fun stuff. Oh, yeah, and I was in Texas as well. You were in Europe. You were in France, probably getting speeding tickets or parking tickets or whatever it is that you get over there, whatever you guys call them over there.
je ne sais pas.
So we got some cool stuff to talk about. First and foremost, you were out at the Paris Auto Show, Motor Show. What's the real name?
The Mondial Paris, the Paris Auto Salon.
Oh, okay.
That sounded German, didn't it?
Yeah,
not French.
Just a little bit.
My girlfriend's French, so I'm supposed to be getting good at this sort of thing, but not really.
Oh, well, she's not listening to this.
No, probably not.
So tell us what's going on there, and I want to get into your little racing event. It's like a huge race with the most ridiculous little car you could find, and some cool stuff that's going on. But what's hot and new and fun or really important to the automotive industry that is coming out of the Paris Auto Show?
Well, I know we've talked about it before on this show, about the kind of the strange death of the auto show. And you turned up in Paris, no Ford, no Volkswagen, no Honda, no Mitsubishi. The kind of list went on. And
it's just all Citroën.
All Citroën or Peugeot.
Yeah.
And it used to turn up at Paris. And Paris was famous for having the worst press office in the world. I don't want to sound like spoiled media, but it used to be about 6 inches square. This year, palatial.
Like right, because they have the square footage, because you took Ford's booth.
Exactly. And we suddenly realized, oh, this thing's amazing. And suddenly realized where the OEMs used to be, where all the manufacturers used to live.
Yeah.
But it's still a good show. I mean, the big news from our perspective, new BMW 3 Series. Yeah, this is like the Ford F-150 for BMW. It's a vehicle that you just can't get wrong. They built 15 million 3 Series now since they first brought it
out. Let's talk about the 3 Series for a second. The 3 Series is a very important car for BMW. They sell a lot of those. They've had sort of the trophy for that segment for so long, and then I don't know if they lost it or what. So the question is this: is the last, I don't know, however many years where it felt like it wasn't as dominant, is it because the 3 Series couldn't keep up with what it needs to be, or did all the other cars become better?
I think it's a mixture of stuff. I mean, remember that the growth of the SUV, I mean, the 3 Series remains a sedan, and that market is in decline across the world. So people are buying X3s, they're buying Q5s, GLCs, that sort of thing for the same money. So there's been a natural decline in the market. And also the 3 Series, it's almost like BMW is paranoid about moving it on. I looked at the new one. It's marginally longer, marginally wider, marginally, a bit more power, a bit more space. But overall, it's still a 3 Series. And when you look at it, it's instantly recognizable from the front, at least, a 3 Series. At the back, actually, I thought it has a bit of Lexus about it.
Yeah.
It's so conservative. And, you know, they just don't take a risk with it. But it also means that, you know, that's a market that's dwindling and it'll continue to dwindle.
But they also, they have to do a Halo version of it, right? They have to do an M3 or an M4 or something in that class. Both historically, that's what it is. And that's kind of what drives a lot of attention in the magazines, you know.
For sure.
You know, sure, you're going to find reviews all over the place for the 3 series, but the covers of the magazines want an M3, right?
They do. And actually, when you look at, I was looking at the engine lineup, and it'll arrive next March with a 330i, which is a 2-liter turbo that we're familiar with. That's 255 horsepower. But then following that next summer is the M340i. You know, BMW do these M cars that aren't M cars.
Yeah, so like an M performance car, some trim packages and stuff like that. And you, I don't know if I like that.
Yeah, I'm with you. Yeah. So, but the M340i has a 6, which has 382 horsepower. And BMW is saying 0 to 60, 4.2 seconds. So it's like, where does that leave the M3? It's interesting. I mean, these things are getting faster and faster and faster, and it's getting harder to create that halo around the M3.
Yeah. So an what's an M3 horsepower now?
Well, we're well over 400, aren't we?
Got to be over 400, right? So
I can't remember the top of my head.
I don't know. The new one has got to be 450, whatever this new one comes out.
Well, if you've got a 340i with 382, yeah, you've got to be 450, 500.
Yeah.
It's just getting silly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, M5 or something now is like 540, or is it up to 600?
Yeah,
now?
And then they do the sport packs on, then the additional packs on top of that.
Right. Just, so what is it like 560 horse and maybe 600 or 540
horse?
You can get
up to 600 now.
Yeah, 600 with the performance pack. So yeah, I guess you can start knocking on the door of 500 horsepower in an M3,
which is enough.
Seems like it's enough. I'm having my M3, my 2001 M3s back at the shop. We're changing the bracket system and the pulley system, more belt wrap, because on the high RPMs I was getting some belt slip on the supercharger, but that should be 500.
Yeah.
That should be 500 horsepower when it's done.
Without the chassis to go with it.
Yeah. It's going to be missing a few things, like possibly a reinforced differential or whatever. No, it'll be fine. It's got street tires on it. It's fine.
No, with your talent.
Yeah. So that should be pretty interesting with the 3 Series. But the 3 Series car is still sort of the basis for some of the SUVs as well, right? Like, I mean, where are we with an X3? Is an X3 that much different suspension-wise and platform-wise than a 3 Series car?
No, I mean, this is where...
That's what makes an X3 good, right? Is it's basically just a big-bodied, lifted...
Yeah, it's the same with things like the Honda CR-V and all these vehicles. And this is the interesting thing about when Ford came out and said, we're not making cars anymore, and this is why the whole thing got so kind of mishandled in the end, is that, you know, a contemporary SUV, we're not talking about the old-fashioned ladder frame with a body on top. These are basically jacked-up cars. So they're wagons with a slightly different body shape.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's easy to kind of, everybody talks about the growth of the SUV. It's a subtly bit, at the end of the day, it's a subtly different body style.
That's what it is. It's just, and now it's funny because when the SUV started, you're right, ladder frame, everything was big.
And really crude.
You know, Explorer came out and we've had this unibody version of an SUV, but now the SUVs are getting smaller.
Yes. I mean, you're seeing a big growth in the compact SUV, things like Honda CR-Vs, but also what, you know, the industry calls subcompact, which is things like, you know, Q3 and that sort of thing, X2.
Well, X1?
Yeah, X1 as well would fit into that, yeah.
We have a 1 and a 2 and a 3 well, and X, a 4 yeah. I mean, and a 5?
And an X7, which was announced.
And a 6 and a 7.
Well, the BMW X7 has just been announced. I had a sneak peek of that before yesterday, actually. That is an ugly vehicle. Have you seen that?
Oh. I saw the concept, kind of a flat nose and
yeah, it basically, yeah. It's this kind of
a little more chiseled edges. Actually, kind of looked like a Volvo.
Yeah,
had a little bit of Volvo to it.
They felt the need that because I mean, this is already a very big vehicle, so it already has a lot of road presence. And then they've stuck this enormous kidney grille onto the front of it. Check out. I mean, we'll be actually going live with the piece on edmunds.com/roadnoise, which is our new editorial page. Check out that. We'll be running taking a first look at it. It is a brood of a car. Lovely interior, seven seats.
Right. But so yeah, this is a three row.
Yeah,
SUV.
It's like a Lincoln Navigator, but by BMW.
Does BMW have a three row SUV currently? I don't think so.
You can get extra rows in an X5, but not a proper.
Right. It's got to be some sort of like jump seat or something.
Yeah. Right? Whereas this is a kind of a proper seven seater, gigantuan family hauler. But it's super aggressive.
Okay, so other than looks, though, there's a market for it. Like, what else is there? I mean, we're kind of stuck. I don't know why. Maybe Mercedes hasn't been able to, like, really sort of break into this, but it's like, especially in L.A., maybe it's just an L.A. thing.
They have the GLE, you know, the big,
But nobody, but who gets it, right? Yeah. Like, out here, you get a Range Rover.
Yeah, but a Range Rover is quite small compared to an X7.
Like a full-size Rover.
Yeah, if
like
you go big, for the...
HSE, Rover.
Yeah, you can have the long wheelbase, but then that's still only five seats or four seats, whereas the X7 will be a full seven-seater. So you're sort of looking at a Land Rover Discovery, but it's going to be bigger than that, and it'll have more presence than that.
But out here, in this town especially, like Range Rover is pretty much the only option that people buy. I mean, you see some Mercedes. If you're getting into something fairly large,
yeah,
right. Everybody, you know, Cayennes you see all the time, and you'll see. I see a lot more Q5s than I do Q7s. I can't remember the last time I actually noticed a Q7.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, so I'm not sure what's going on there. And yeah, you see the Mercedes, but the big what's the big SUV? GLC? K?
GLK is a little one. GLE. Well, GLE is the big. It's the because you
GL.
Have the G wagon. Yeah, the G wagon, which is the the cool off road thing, and
silly.
Then the GL is the
yeah. So the GL, but I mean, think of how many Range Rovers we see out here versus a GL.
Yeah.
And so I guess there's room in this segment for BMW to come in and go, hey, we want to do a big, arguably big SUV in this segment. But, you know, does it really compete with a Navigator or the Cadillac?
Well, I think that's that's the market they're after. I think both in the U.S. and also in places like China, Middle East, there's a demand for these big, big, imposing vehicles. Be interesting.
Yeah. Well, there's also Cullinan.
Pardon?
There's the Rolls-Royce SUV.
There is, yeah, if you want to go really big.
Yeah, it's big. It's physically
big. Do you like it?
I saw them at Goodwood, like all in the camoed up, and I think we saw them in Monterey, and... we peeked in one, and it's very Rolls Royce. But Rolls Royce for me was always about how it drives.
Yeah,
that their famous magic carpet ride. So that's I couldn't tell you if I like it or not. You just got to drive it. I don't care what it looks like. If it drives like a Rolls Royce, I'm like, it's a nice vehicle it's like the greatest road trip car.
It's a nice thing to be in, isn't it, or to be driven in?
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I get it. So, look, you want a Rolls Royce. You're in that market for a Rolls Royce. Go and get one. And my thought is, like, we drove the Rolls Royce Ghost a couple of years ago to Monterey, and that thing was amazing. So my thought is this is a $300,000, $325,000 car. This is a great road trip car. You should just wait 3 years and buy one for $130,000, and you get the nicest riding car out there. For one third the cost. Sorry, Rolls Royce.
I spend a lot of time looking on things like bring a trailer and looking at those old Rolls Royce and Bentley Turbo R's and everything else. But you just and they are incredibly cheap for what they are. But you just know they're a massive money pit.
I don't know why you and I constantly surf around for the most unreliable shit we can buy.
I was just actually going back for a moment to the Mercedes SUV line because I think we were all getting confused about GLS and GLEs and everything else. In Paris, there was a new GLE, which is the E-Class size one. The big seven-seater, which is the X7 rival, that's the GLS. So Mercedes realigned they realigned everything to try and link it up with where the sedan range is. But the new GLE, which has also got seven
GLS,
seats.
Because GLS series is the big car.
Is the really big fella. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the GLE is based on the E-Class. That was new in Paris.
Yeah.
So that's also got seven seats. But again, a bit like the X5, they're going to be sort of kids only. That is a fairly generic SUV, but I mean, one thing Mercedes is doing really well, and they had the GLE on the stand there. They also had the EQC, which is their new
electric SUV. And what do you think?
I think their interiors, Mercedes interiors are, alongside Audi, pretty much the best in the business now. They're terrific.
And when's the electric come out?
So the EQC is coming out next year. So basically what you're seeing is Audi coming to the market with the e-tron, Mercedes entering with the EQC.
And are they I-Pace size?
Yes.
Jaguar I-Pace size?
They are. They'll be I-Pace rivals, but the I-Pace is more, I mean, Jaguar calls it an SUV, but it's more, it's kind of like a mix between, I nearly said hybrid, but that's confusing. It's more of a mix between a sedan and an SUV, whereas the EQC, we're almost seeing like the normalization of electric cars, that the e-tron and the EQC actually look like pretty conventional SUVs.
Do you think the strategy for Jaguar is going to pay off in that they're basically going to be out a year before the others?
I hope so. I mean, Jaguar, if you look at their sales figures at the moment, is a bit of a disaster. They're struggling to sell the sedans. The F-Type is getting old. You know, the I-Pace, there's lots of talk at the moment about Jaguar going for an all-electric strategy going forwards. So the next XJ will be electric and so on. And
you say that, but I just read in the rumor mill, and not to put you on the spot because you like facts, not rumors, but the next version of the F-Type could have a twin-turbo V8 BMW sourced engine.
It could, and I think this
true
is,
or not true.
I've also heard about that.
So it's true that you've also read it.
I think the problem is they're still trying to work out where they're going, and maybe we'll see another F-Type, which is gasoline, and then we'll transition. But I think the next XJ will be electric. And the problem is your Jaguar, they're just struggling to make an impact across. Well, the I-Pace is a big chance for them, but do enough people even know about it? I mean, we're car guys; we talk about it on shows like this.
Yeah.
You know, it's all over the Edmunds website, but there's so many, you know, out. You just don't see them, and if you don't see them, people don't think about them, and that's Jaguar's big problem. Because I'm a big fan of the I-Pace. I think it's a great looking vehicle. It's different. It's interesting.
Yeah.
The EQC and the e-tron, they're fine. They'll drive well. They'll be super quiet. Mercedes actually made a big mess up of the launch of the EQC, because they came out and said, here's our new electric vehicle. We think it'll have a range of 200 miles, which is massively less than the e-tron and the I-Pace. So it's like saying 200 miles, that's good. You know, electric cars are still all about range anxiety. How far can
I
get?
They basically just said, we're going to make an inferior electric vehicle.
Pretty much.
That's what the public hears when you say 200. We go, well, I-Pace does 240 or whatever.
So already
they're winning.
So I got to Paris and I said, guys, what's going on? And they said, well, actually, we kind of put out a correction, and now it could be like 250 miles. And
yeah, nobody read that correction.
The problem is in Europe, the way that they measure electric range is different. So if you look at the range in Europe, it's always bigger than it is in the US, even if it's the same thing. So the whole market is hugely confused. We've actually just partnered with a company. We're actually looking to start calculating, empirically measuring real range of electric vehicles. This is something we're working on in the background, so it's quite exciting for us. It'll take us a little bit of time to get it done, but at the moment, nobody's doing that. Nobody's actually, even the EPA stuff is taken on
trust.
How
are you going to do it? Because you got that super nerd Dan Edmonds working over there?
We have Dan working on, but we also have a few people who actually make Dan look lacking in nerdiness, if that is possible.
What? How is that possible?
Guys who can out-nerd Dan. But some really interesting technology that we're pioneering at the moment to try and get a better measurements, not only of MPG but also of electric car range.
Yeah, in the electric car world, because we're talking about that now, is interesting that Jaguar selected, because Jaguar Land Rover is one company, and I feel like Land Rover is paying all the bills for the rest of the company right now, because they still sell quite a few of those, right? They're at least record numbers. Like, they keep doing better.
Yeah.
Why launch an electric SUV, if you will, or a crossover, if you will, as a Jaguar instead of something in the Land Rover lineup? Unless it's their way of saying, pay attention to Jaguar.
I think that's true, to be honest.
Because why not do like a Velar type Range Rover?
And they will have to do that in due course. I mean, I think one of the problems with Land Rover, of course, is how it works off road and everything else. That opens up a whole different, because a Land Rover.
Yeah, I guess you're right. Yeah, there are some sort of mandates for that brand.
Yeah, part of Land Rover's DNA is still to be the best equivalent off roader in its class. I mean, it gets a bit tenuous now with things like the Velar, but it's still part of their DNA that this thing must be capable off road. The I-Pace will go up a grassy track. But I think you're right. They needed to give Jaguar a bit of an injection. you know, to actually get people talking about it again.
It's funny because I agree with you. Mercedes kind of screwed the pooch on their announcement of their electric vehicle, whereas Jaguar has been able to reap the benefits of getting out there a year ahead of time and doing something that's fairly innovative. And the only real competitor right now is the Tesla.
Yeah.
And Tesla's already gotten all the press they need for their vehicle, good, bad, or otherwise.
Yeah.
So now sort of all eyes are on the Jag, and I think it has potential. And then, but you like it, the I-Pace.
Yeah, I like the I-Pace.
Yeah.
It's a good-looking thing. It's spacious. It's different. I mean, they're expensive. You know, they're starting $65,000, so you probably end up spending more than that. The lease rates for Jaguars aren't always the best. So, you know, it's a chunk of change.
Yeah, you're going to spend it's going to be 85 grand by the time you get it called up and stuff. Like, nobody's buying a stripped down Jag, right? What's the point? Like, it's a premium brand, it's a premium mark. Like, you know, that's what you're getting with Jag. You get a nice Jag.
You do, and interestingly, in Paris, Kia launched the Niro EV. We're actually got on test at the moment, the Hyundai equivalent, the Kona. So there's a lot of vehicles coming in at that kind of $35,000 mark, which have now got big ranges, well over 200 miles, which are competing with these kind of luxury brands. And suddenly the electric car is not the kind of Tesla fancy of the kind of affluent, the affluence on the coast. Suddenly they're becoming a lot more accessible, and that's great. And they're really good vehicles.
Okay, so what else is going on at that show? So we talked about BMW, Mercedes, electric vehicles. Where's the fun stuff? Or there's some important stuff too. You're going to be like, hey, there's a really sweet Kia, or there's
the Niro EV looks a decent thing. I mean, as I said, it's a bit of a dying art. We saw the 911 Speedster, which is the worst kept secret in the world that this is now happening for production.
I think they had one at Monterey at Rennsport.
They did.
They had the 935.
That's a cool thing.
Which is cool. And then next to it, they had the Speedster, and it kind of got overshadowed by the 935 because it was Rennsport and it's a racing event.
Yeah.
And then we came home, and a few days later, they're like, Porsche announced a Speedster, and it's got the red car. I'm like, didn't we just see
that? They've been saying it's been a bit of nonsense. They've been saying for ages, the concept Speedster.
Yeah.
And it's a very kind of Germanic way. Everything's very controlled.
Yeah. Although that does also prove our point of they technically did pretty much show it at Rennsport first, as opposed to an auto show. They didn't pull out of the auto show, but they still took advantage of a specialty event and announced another car. And that's sort of going the way of what these manufacturers are doing.
It is, but the big one from Porsche will be the new 911, which will be debuting here in LA.
Yes. When? At the LA Auto Show?
Yeah, the LA Auto Show, the end of November. Yeah.
We got a chance to, when we were at Rennsport, to talk with some Porsche people about the Mission E.
Yeah, or Taycan.
Taycan.
Taycan. Taycan.
Taycan?
Taycan. Taycan. Something like that, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's what it's really
called. That's what it's really called, yeah. Because you had a great name that everybody recognized, and then they called it then they changed it. Yeah, Taycan.
Yeah.
They told me how to pronounce it, and I can't remember whether it's a bit like Porsche or Porsche. It's either
Macan came out.
I can't remember this Taycan. I know it's supposed to be either Taycan or Taycan. It's one of the two. They corrected me, but I don't know. I mean, that's a problem. You know, apart from the silly name, that's a beautiful looking thing.
That's going to be an important car for them, right? That's going to be a really big deal.
Yeah, and this is, as we're saying, like the kind of all the electric cars coming in. This is a big test. I mean, Tesla's kind of Tesla, and that's a separate thing. But, you know, is the world going to embrace an electric car from Porsche? What is an electric car from Porsche? You know,
it has to have Porsche DNA, just the way we were saying, any Land Rover has to have Land Rover DNA, you know, electric or otherwise. Right?
But it can't have a rev counter, clearly.
Yeah.
It can't have, you know, it's not going to sound good because it's an electric car. So, you know, it'd be interesting to see. I mean, it's going to drive well, I'm sure, but how that car plays out and what the audience is for it.
Yeah.
You know, this is happening. We've got to stop coming on show. We're not sort of, we can't be deniers that this is the new world order, and it's coming a lot faster than what we think.
But look, you're right. There's not going to be an RPM gauge or something fun to see as you're throwing it around the track, but they're going to do something, right?
There'll be some gimmick.
Some sort of power gauge,
yeah.
You know, some sort of, you know, something that's showing you power, kilowatts or horsepower or, you know, muscles.
For sure. For
you know,
sure.
Some sort of muscle gauge.
You will still have a rotary dial in front of you that will,
and I'm sure it'll be all digital and everything, but it you have to kind of show that. That's the point of Porsche is to do something.
And
like
it's
that.
Such a fabulous looking car as well.
It is kind of cool. And we got in this big argument with them. Not an argument, just a discussion about. Adam has brought this up as well on the show, is why do we still have mirrors? Why do we still have exterior mirrors on car? They look like shit.
Yeah.
And it's a technology that we invented 100 years ago. And the car companies are like, well, we don't need them. But the government's like, hey, here's a rule we made 100 years ago. Let's go ahead and stick with it because I don't know why.
Yeah.
It's just like when now, you know, cameras and sensors and everything else would be far better than the mirror. And I know the car companies are like, here's an Audi and where your mirrors would be, but inside the car you have little monitors. You can use that. Like that's just them. That's not them trying to tease us. That's them trying to get in front of the government and go, this is better.
Yeah, this is sort of happening. I read a really interesting the other day that made me laugh because we talk about autonomous cars and say, oh my God, you know, cars driving themselves, this is so dangerous. And then somebody said, like, think about it in 50 years' time. People are going to look back and say, you let humans drive a car looking into mirrors whilst talking on a phone,
yeah,
you know, checking their text messages, you know, disciplining the kids in the back seat.
Yeah.
It'll just seem like madness.
I'm telling you, mirrors, exterior mirrors are going to go the way of crank windows.
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense, right? They're ugly. For a long time, they're loud. Right, they have to cut through the wind. The aerodynamics are shit.
Yeah,
like it just doesn't make sense. And right now, you know, as governments around the world are going, hey, it's all about clean air and fuel economy. And they're like, okay, let's have a mirrors conversation because that's a big factor in all of that.
But if you tried, I think it's the Lincoln does the where they have the little video image in the interior mirror.
Yeah,
you know, you tried one of those.
Yeah,
that, but you lose all your depth perception. They're quite weird things to work with because they arguably give you a better view, but you lose that sort of sense of depth of perception. So you go from looking at the real world forwards and then you look in this and you've got this like little video image and it takes a little bit of time to get used to.
Because it's on the mirror as well and it's confusing your eyes because you're going back and forth between the two things. But you're telling me now that we have so many reverse cameras that when I'm backing out of a spot, I can't remember the last time I used a rear view mirror on a new car. Now, my Alfa Romeo is different.
I had to do my, I don't even mention this last night, I had to do my driving test about a month ago.
Yeah.
US person. I did.
Should we even bring that up on the air, considering your job?
Do you know how nervous I was? and this is all part of moving to the US.
What side of the road do you want me to start on?
Yeah, God. I don't generally get nervous about things. I don't get nervous sitting here doing this, but I was properly, you know, you could feel the adrenaline going because I thought the implications of failing this, they just...
Yeah.
Particularly as I was supposed to do the ZR1 GT3 test the following day. So we got in the car. And
That was on a track, so you'd be okay.
So we did the little driving, the reverse, can you reverse in a straight line? And the driving instructor said to me, I did it in a Chevy Bolt. And it has one of the screens in the middle where it has a little 360 cameras. And the driving examiner started asking me about the technology halfway through the test. And he's like, is there a little camera that's above the car? How does it do that? It's like, whoa.
Yeah, wait a minute. Yeah. So wait, when you do it, do they make you put your arm up and look out the rear window like you're supposed to from back in the day? Or
has the
driving test evolved and like, you're not staring at your dash. You need to stare at your dash.
Well, it was 24 years since I did my last one. So I sat there thinking, I'm not even sure what I'm supposed to do anymore.
Yeah.
You know, I learned my hand signals. So I did my hand signals, got all that.
Did you study?
Yeah. I spent a couple of hours reading the handbook and everything else because you get asked to go through all that. And also controls are called different things over here, an emergency brake, and I didn't know what that was. And
what do you guys
the hand
call
signals.
It?
Parking brake.
Oh, well, okay.
Okay, but, you know, all these things matter. Terrifying experience, but we're through that now. So we're fully bona fide.
Yeah. All right. Well, you passed. So what else is going on at Paris Auto Show?
Well, Paris. After Paris, I jumped in a Kia Stinger, which I'm a big fan of, and headed out to Spa-Francorchamps. And I did a 24-hour race in a car with 68 horsepower.
Okay, hold on. First, Kia Stinger. I like what they're doing. It's kind of sporty. It's a cool sedan. I feel like the media loves it. They're not going to sell any.
They're putting big incentives behind it. I think you're right. I think the problem, for me, it's what I like about it is it's a really well-executed car. It's great to drive. I think it looks terrific. The interior is nice. You've just got to get past the idea of spending all that money on a Kia.
What does it cost?
Well, you see, this is where you get into what the deal is. So you're well into the 30s.
Well, what's the sticker on that thing?
The sticker on that thing is in about 35. I'm going to have to double check.
Yeah, 30, mid-30s to high-30s probably.
But the thing is, what they're doing on this is they're actually putting in a lot of incentives. So if you walk into your Kia dealer today, we know because we get some of the data on this that you get a lot of incentives behind these cars. So there's a great deal to be done. And the big challenge for these guys is basically to say, can you get people to swap their BMW 3 Series that we talked about earlier and get them into a Kia? And what I quite like about it
is the Stinger bigger than a 3 Series?
It is bigger than a 3 Series.
Is it more 5 Series?
Yeah, so it's actually overarching 32,900 they start at.
Right,
both 35, as I was saying, 35 when they're kind of on the road in the form that you want them to be.
So it's exactly what a Model 3 was supposed to cost.
Exactly. but I think it's a really confident statement. I really like it. I like the idea of turning up saying, you know what? I'm comfortable in my skin. I bought a Kia because it's a great car.
Can you get it with a manual?
No.
Eh.
Rubbish.
Just wanted something sporty, extra sporty if I was going to do it. Like, why did you get a Stinger? Because it's kind of sporty and I get it with a manual.
But I brought it into the racing paddock at Spa, and loads of people were looking at it. You don't see many in Europe. Everybody was getting excited by it. And you think, actually, this is a good thing for Kia. Kia's desperately trying to move their image forwards. And I just think it's great that they've had the guts to actually build something like that, bring it to market. They know it's going to be a struggle to sell up against, you know, BMW, that sort of thing, for that money. But it's a great vehicle, really well executed, and, you know, you've got to support that.
We did see one in Europe when we were at Goodwood on the streets out there. We saw one, and it was yellow. It was all yellow.
Okay.
That's what we said. Okay. Well, and kept driving.
Well, we have one on our long-term test fleet at Edmunds here in LA, and so we're driving it daily, and it's well-liked. It's been a good car for us.
Okay. So tell us about your race. You went to Spa.
So I went to Spa, where the home of the Belgium Grand Prix.
Okay.
And this is a race.
And you drove what?
I drove a Citroën. So this the background to this, you remember two CVs, the De Chevaux, the French farmer's car, the little snail car?
Yeah.
So years ago, they started racing these because it was super cheap. And then there started being a 24-hour race. So it was basically like, how cheap can you go 24-hour racing? And then as time went on, the 2CV became a classic car and parts got more sparse. And now it says, and everything got more expensive. So, well, what's next? And a few years ago, Citroën, Peugeot, and Toyota combined to do like a little European city car. It was the C1, it was the Peugeot 107, and then they had the Toyota Aygo.
Nothing we've ever seen out here.
No. I mean, it'd be terrifying on the 405. You know, like.
I drove it out for a Mayo Spider here.
Yeah,
so.
That's true. So they started racing them. And it's just gone crazy.
Explain, what does it look like? Does it look like a smart car? Does it look like a Fiat 500? Like, so to Americans, what are we picturing?
Yeah, if you picture a Fiat 500, probably a good analogy. It's that kind of size.
Yeah.
Two doors, 1 liter, 3-cylinder engine, 68 horsepower, obviously stick shift.
And it's super new-ish? Simple. What year is the car?
They're going back, when were they introduced? 10, 15 years ago. So about to. But
you're racing something fairly new. This isn't like a bunch of vintage Mini Coopers.
No. Right. So these are basically, the rules are super tight. So you can tweak the springs and the dampers. You obviously put a roll cage in, a race seat. You can strip them out to a point, but you still have to have a working radio, for example. This is all part of the regs.
Mm-hmm.
You run around on super cheap tires. And the whole idea of it is to make it as cost-effective as possible. So we did a full 24-hour race, 5 drivers in the team.
And then how much horsepower?
68.
So you did like one lap?
A lap
in 24 hours.
A lap round Spa. My fastest lap was a 339 or 338, something like that.
Yeah. So you could basically pass your crew in the pit, and then they can go to the bathroom and grab some coffee and come back, and then you're back in there.
Yeah.
You know, Laguna Seca in a 935, you've only got a minute and a half, minute 40 before the car comes around again.
And Eau Rouge, that famous corner where you sort of blast down the hill at Spa, and then you do this right level you see in F1 and sports car racing, and, you know, that's flat. So you're flat in Eau Rouge. Absolutely. And maybe a down change. Just to get up the hill. But you know what was great about it? You had 122 cars, and we had a problem in qualifying. Our transponder broke, so we ended up at the back. So we were 122nd starting this race.
Sweet.
And we got up to 14th, and the fuel pump broke, and then we fixed that, and that cost us about 45 minutes. So we ended up 23rd in class or something. But it was just so much fun, and it just proves that you don't need to have a McLaren or a Ferrari or something.
It's just all momentum. Don't even use the brakes.
And really difficult to drive, because you get used to race cars, and as long as you've got your setup working reasonably well, then race cars do what race cars do, and you know how to drive them and everything else. Whereas this thing, you know, it rolls, and you kind of have to chuck it in and then wait till the suspension sets, then kind of fire it out the corner with as much as you can with 68 horsepower. So there's a real art to driving them. And the guys that were racing them all the time, I went out and I was like, how the hell are you doing this? You know, these guys were coming past me, disappearing. And eventually you kind of get into a rhythm with it. But because there's no power and it's all conservation momentum, it actually teaches you to be a better driver, because you can't throw this thing around. You know, it's all about how do you... You know, manage the. You,
it
manage
has to the be
inertia,
the perfect line, perfect exit speeds and turns, like, because there's no way to make it up with power.
And it's not like Le Mans or something like that. This is a serious motor race. So you set off and you do 24-hour racing just as you would at Le Mans, and the guys are friendly, taking it very seriously, and driver changes, people are pitching themselves in and out and all the rest of it, practicing pit stops. And
yeah,
it's a serious motor race. It's just all about keeping the cost down, having fun. And you know, it cost me, I mean, motorsport's expensive, we know, but the whole thing cost me just over $2,000, which for a 24-hour race in, you know, motorsport terms...
Like, at Laguna Seca, you can't even get a hotel room for that much money.
Exactly, a burger.
Yeah, right? So that's fine. If you could do a whole event like that...
And it's just, you know, you're there, you've got four other friends, guys that you're doing with. We're sort of sitting towards the end of the race, sitting there. There's a glorious bar at Spa overlooking the end of the circuit, you know, cigar, glass of port. I thought, this is, life gets no better than this.
That's how you double the racing budget, is at the
exactly.
end you have a glass of brandy or something, and then your cigar, and you're like, wow, we just doubled the racing budget.
Yeah.
Four guys, drinks around, and
but amazing fun. Really, really good fun.
What made you go out and do this?
Well, these are guys that I used to race with in Europe. I used to race Caterham 7s in Europe and a few of the bits and pieces. And they just bought this car as a bit of fun. Because I think it was this passion that everybody has to do. You know, we, particularly in Europe, but I guess over here as well with Daytona, that you know, 24-hour racing is a very different thing. It's a team sport. It's not as individualistic. You know, it's a challenge, physical, mental challenge. So this is a way of getting into endurance racing at a cheap price. And I think it's something that could be exported over here really well. So it's not like Le Mans. It's actually a serious motor race.
Yeah.
But, you know, in cars that cost nothing and, you know, have no horsepower. But actually, you also get a lot of pros turning. Andy Prio, who did Le Mans in the Ford GT, he wasn't there in Spa, but he's done a previous round. We had professional GT drivers in my sister team. There was a professional GT driver. So it just attracts, you know, a whole bunch of people.
You guys must have a good crew going from 122 up to 14 at one point.
Yeah, we were doing okay. I mean, there's a few cars at the back, like a couple of 2 series about that you kind of cruise past. But then, yeah, quite a disparity in driving standard. And of course, you're trying to manage the car a little bit as well, stay off some of the tougher curbs and what have you. But yeah, we did pretty well. We're pretty proud of ourselves for a bunch of, you know, old grain guys.
Yeah, did you guys shoot some video? Is there any of it we can see?
In fact, as Shane put, if you watch, we just launched a new show on Edmunds, a weekly show. Nice segue.
Ah. Oh.
Do you see what I did there?
It's like I've done this before.
If you head to edmunds.com/roadnoise,
okay,
you can see a new weekly show that we've just launched. It's a 3-minute roundup of the automotive week. It's something that we're running every Friday at 9 a.m. Pacific time, or I keep saying midday, you don't say that over here, or 12 p.m. On the East Coast, and this will be a kind of 3-minute roundup every week of everything that's going on in the automotive world. So we covered Paris, new vehicles being launched. There's a little bit of footage in there from my race at Spa, new vehicles that we've been testing, just drove the Volvo S60, for example. That's in there. So I think anybody listening to this show should enjoy it. And we've actually inviting people to comment, and we're going to evolve this as the weeks go by. So, you know, if people want to watch it and offer us some commentary, then it'd be great to hear what people think about it.
New videos go up every
Friday.
Every Friday in the morning out here. You obviously don't need to tune in exactly at that time. The videos aren't going anywhere.
For sure. It's like a podcast,
effectively. That's kind of when they get posted. And I think one of your videos you touch on the new 911.
Yeah.
Right. What's your thoughts on that? What do you know about the new 911? Because we're Porsche fans, and
it looks like a 911.
It looks like a 911, right? And
the only thing that we know, I mean, we've seen pretty
like a little more horsepower across the lineup, and
a little more horsepower. It's all going to have a slightly wider body. So you know the Targa does today, or the Carrera 4s, which have that red strip across the back of the car.
Yeah.
And we used to see it in sort of special models in the past. So this is now going to be a Porsche signature across the board. So the new Macan has got it. The Taycan, whatever, has got it. The new 911 will have that as well. So it will be more that kind of red Porsche strip is going to become a signature.
Right, the rear taillight plastic area, yeah, kind of thing.
That it goes all the way across. Yeah, it's on the Panamera as well.
And they're all basically kind of wider body now. They basically kind of have the hips of a Carrera 4 or a...
That, yeah,
yeah.
They're all going to have the hips. There's going to be a hybrid model eventually, not for launch. We think that the next GT3, which we've already got pictures of testing, that will be naturally... There's a lot of rumors about will it be turbocharged, will it be naturally aspirated. We're pretty certain that that one will be naturally aspirated, at least this generation. So if you're a collector, my hunch is that...
This is the last of the naturally aspirated.
A stick shift version of this GT3 could be the one to buy
Because then that's it. That's it.
I think that's
it. What do you think they're going to launch with? It's just a Carrera, a 4, turbo, and a GT3? Would there be a GTS in there? Would there be a Turbo S in there? Like, what do you think they'll launch with? And then when will we get other versions?
To be honest, every Porsche generally follows a fairly standard process. So they launch the Carrera, they launch the, if you like, the normal model, the Carrera, Carrera S first, all-wheel drive. Then you get the turbo. Then you generally get the first of the GT3s. The GTS comes a little bit, then comes later. For example, if you look at the Panamera, we're actually heading out to Bahrain to drive the new Panamera GTS, which was only announced yesterday. Check it out on edmunds.com/roadnoise. And that went live yesterday. And this is Porsche does the same thing every time. So we'll launch first with like the cooking versions, and then they'll ramp up the horsepower. And then the GT... For me, the GTS...
Maybe the Targa?
The Targa will come in. Targa always comes later as well. That's normally a year or two into the model cycle. Likewise, the Cabriolet normally comes a little bit later. I mean, for me, the GTS, pretty much in any Porsche lineup, we saw it with the Macan, we saw it with the previous, the 911, it's generally always the GTS is the one to go for. You just have to wait a bit for that.
The GTS, I agree, has always been... Porsche is so a la carte with all of their options, and it gets very, very expensive.
Yeah.
I mean, you could take a Boxster or 918 Boxster, whatever it is now, and be like, hey, it's $62,000.
Well, we just had a Boxster. I think it was 80 grand. We just,
that's still cheap because I'm sure you could spend 100 on that thing.
Carbon seats and all the rest of it.
So, for what you know about the new 911 now, would you tell people wait and get the new one, or you're fine just going to what we have on the lot today?
I don't think we're going to need to wait. I mean, there's always a bit of
Other than being fresh and new and sexy, but how much different is it really?
Do you know there's always a lot of ego tripping with 911s? You know, I've turned up at track days and standard Carrera, and it's like, oh, where's your S badge? Or where's your GTS badge? The reality is that even the standard 911 is a fabulous sports car, and sometimes less is more. That's why I love the Carrera T so much. So I would say don't wait. If you're in the market for it, I mean, obviously we need to drive it, and we have this kind of rule that every car is crap until proven otherwise.
Yeah.
And I think it's really important. You know, we shouldn't get excited about these things, so we've driven them. And, you know, Porsche has made mistakes. In fact, when you look at going from the 993 to the 996, everybody's like, ooh. Whereas this one, to be honest, it's a gentle evolution of a 991.
And when are they coming out? Next year? Sometime mid-next
year? We'll be insurance
next year. If you want a 911, you're probably going to lease it anyway, right?
Yeah.
Unless you're buying one of the specialty ones, one of the GT cars, go get yourself your 3-year lease. And a year from now, when the new ones come out, you'll be a year into your lease. And then at the end of 3 years, some of the hotter models, GTSs and Targas and Turbos, will be out. And then you'll be able to trade yours in today and get the new one.
The other thing I'd say is have a look. I mean, the outgoing car is still fabulous.
Yeah.
Have a look at it. Sometimes you can get deals on an outgoing model. And if you know, if you're suddenly getting $5,000-$10,000 off a, you know, or a fantastic, there's some fantastic lease deals on outgoing Macans because the new model's here and everybody knows about it.
Yeah.
So even in Porsche world, you tend to, you know, that it's still worth looking at what deals are out there, because if you can get a fabulous deal on a GTS or a Carrera T or something like that, then go for it.
Yeah, but you're right. But more of the, if you, for lack of a better term, more of the cookie cutter Porsches, they're pretty much subject to like any other car company. But like when the new versions are coming out, they need to sell what they have on the lot, right?
Yeah.
They need to move those cars somehow, you know, or if there's something even a year old and it's got a couple of miles on it and you want to save a couple of bucks, like, you know, it's still okay to go and get those cars. Those cars are good.
Oh, they're,
you know,
fabulous.
They're
cars,
fantastic.
Yeah.
So go and do that. So we're going to run a little bit out of time, but I'll tell you guys that I went to Texas. You saw some of my social media. I went to Texas. I was going out there for a wedding in Austin. So I flew into Houston to meet with a buddy of mine. Who drives a Hennessy twin turbo Raptor, by the way.
In Texas.
Yeah.
With a big hat.
Yeah. He's got an 800 horsepower turbo Raptor.
Wow, I'd love to go in that.
Yeah, it's cool. It's badass. It's pretty it's pretty nice. It's, you know, it's not the new Raptor. It's the gas engine, you know, non turbo Raptor, you know, whatever it is, the 6.2 liter. But it's you know, it's a couple years old, but it's pretty badass. I mean, it's got too many Hennessy stickers on it, but it's pretty badass. So we got together, we met up for dinner, but I hooked up with Lexus while I was out there, and Lexus lent me the new ES300H, the hybrid. This is a pretty important car for them, right? It's their midsize sedan. I would say, look, it's great. It's a fantastic car. Say what you will about the grill. You love the grill, you hate the grill, whatever. We get that part, right? That they've been doing it for years. They don't give a shit what you think. So it is what it is. Like, they're clearly not changing
trying,
that.
Right? At least they're trying.
Yeah, right? Like, they've committed to it. They like it. You can complain about the grill all you want. It's not going to change. So I don't want to sit there and get all judgy about the grill, right? That predator mouth thing that it has in the front. There's a certain something you expect from Lexus, right? You expect a certain amount of quality. You expect it to be. By the way, I drove the LS, the big Lexus,
yep.
And it is gorgeous. The design on the interior with the wood, with the aluminum slats in the middle, and it goes into the door. Like, it's got some beautiful design elements to it. This car had a little less of that, but it was just, it's still a Lexus. It's done right. You can feel the build quality is good. And nobody's been doing hybrid technology longer than Toyota.
Yeah.
Right? And this sort of falls into that category. It was good. It now has sort of that, maybe it was from the LFA, you know, like up above the dash, the gauges on the side on that the gauge cluster area. It's got the sport button sides. Yeah, you know, the LC has
things.
It.
Yeah.
When you're first looking around, you're like, "Where's the? There's got to be a sport button. Where is it?" Then you realize that it's up higher. It all works. It all works fine. So I took this thing out. I picked it up in Houston, and we went out to dinner, and it was. Surprisingly, it was black with tan interior. There's not a lot of black press cars because they're so hard to photograph.
Yep.
But it looked great. When they delivered it to me, it was really clean, which was nice. But when I gave it back, it was definitely not clean. So I drove it around. I drove it to Austin. It was a couple hours, 2.5 hours, something like that. And I know the hybrids don't get their best gas mileage on the freeway because there's no braking. It doesn't switch back and forth as much. But on that trip, I was averaging 40 miles per gallon. And I'm sure in the city, you could probably get that up to the 42, maybe a little more range. It had one of the best, smoothest transitions between gas engine and EV mode. You can almost not even feel it. Like, you just don't know the difference. And one of the things that frustrates the hell out of me with so many new cars, the gas engine cars, is that start-stop function. every stoplight feels like now you got to give it an extra two beats, right? Because it's got to fire up and you got to go again. On a hybrid car, this Lexus, even something like the NSX, when you get to the stoplight, sure, it shuts down the motor, but you're in EV mode.
Yeah.
So there's no get your foot off the brake, fire up the engine. It's going. It's already going.
Pull
it's in EV mode, right? And by time that engine fires up and does whatever, you didn't notice it happened. You can actually go. Just getting your foot off the brake from stoplight to stoplight is so much better in a hybrid car like this than it is in that stupid start-stop function that frustrates the hell out of me.
Maybe that's why we're talking about the 911. We're all thinking, hybrid 911. But actually, that could be a really nice thing.
Yeah. Well, listen, for Porsche, when they do a hybrid, they want to use it for some amount of performance as well. Like this is McLaren P1. This is Acura NSX. There's a reason for it. Hybrid doesn't need it for that. But I will tell you, this car had fantastic mid-range power. You know, if you're cruising and you hammer down and it seems to pull. I don't know what it's doing. It must be using the electric motor somehow. It doesn't say it's an EV mode, but it must be doing a combination.
You're doing a combination.
Yeah, it is. It was great. I don't know if you've spent much time in it yet.
Not yet. I didn't. We did have one of the team did the launch. I personally haven't got into it. I mean, we talked about the 3 Series. The ES is such an important vehicle for Lexus. That's the cash cow. That's the heartbeat of the range.
Yeah, I would have liked to have seen kind of a baby version of the LS interior, you know, with the wood and the aluminum.
Yeah.
You know, and it blended right into the AC vents and everything. Like the LS, I get. That car is fantastic, by the way. And also the Lexus, we were talking about Jag. I love Jag, but the difference between Lexus and Jaguar is all of the electronics in the Lexus seem to work.
And also the interior quality, actually the I-Pace is better than something like the XE and XF, but the interior quality, the touchy-feely bits.
Yeah.
That's what Lexus has always done. But the whole infotainment thing, that kind of weird little pad that you're trying to do, I can't get on with that.
Yeah, the touchpad thing is weird.
The touchpad thing is probably the worst part of any Lexus, including the LS.
It is weird because there's so many times I want to touch the screen, and then when you plug in your phone and it's got CarPlay, which I love, and every other car you touch the screen for CarPlay, you just hit your messages or your whatever or Waze, you got to use the pad.
And if you hit a bump, you end up on the wrong function.
Yeah, I'm telling you, that part is weird. That part is weird for sure. If it had some sort of dial or joystick or something that you could rest your wrist and move it around. But you're trying to float your finger over it, and you're right. Every little bump or turn makes your finger shoot off in a different direction. I was constantly trying to swipe down. I was like, go back to Waze. Go back to Waze. I'm lost. Go back to Waze. And then I was looking for like the button that, you know, the Siri button, like load Waze or something. Like actually in the Ford Raptor, it was super easy. And this one was a little bit more complicated. But everything did work.
But the whole thing about these things, those systems also be like to remove distraction, make life easy. No. They're all I mean, that's why I think Apple Car, particularly now you can get Google Maps and Waze on it, just makes life easy.
I tell you what it is you hit it on the head. It's trying to make it easier, but because there's no indicator on the trackpad of where you're starting, where your finger is starting, you could be in a left corner, bottom corner, middle. You have to look down to see where your fingers are first. Whereas any type of dial or knob or joystick or something would you can feel it, so now you know where you are. The pad has no indicator.
Yeah.
You know, if it had like a bump or a divot or something in the middle and you just rest your finger on there first, then maybe, but it doesn't have that. All right.
They're just trying too hard.
We're going to wrap things up, guys. Thank you so much for listening. And of course, as you know, we're brought to you by Dodge. Your authorized Dodge dealer invites you to experience a world of performance, design, and fuel efficiency. Schedule a test drive today. Go to Dodge.com and visit your Dodge dealer to learn more about the exciting offers on our powerful lineup. You guys can check out Edmunds.com, and you've got your new show, Road Noise, Edmunds.com/Road Noise. Friday mornings are new episodes. It's a great recap of what's going on. And if you don't like to read, and you just want to watch guys in a video, this is the best thing to happen to automotive news since the internet, I guess. Guys, check that out.
Since the podcast.
Right? Since the podcast. Of course, Edmunds.com. You can follow me at Moderator. I'm on all the social medias, all at Moderator. And we can find Alistair. Where?
at Instagram at Weaver Alistair, Alistair A-L-I-S-T-A-I-R, which they can never spell in Starbucks, or on Twitter it's the other way around, Alistair Weaver.
Alistair Weaver, because somebody's got your identity.
Just like to be different, yeah.
Yeah, all right. Yeah, all right, guys, thank you so much. Thanks, Chris. Good job today.
You too, guys.
Thank you, Chris.
Until next time, keep the air in the spare and the bag in the wheel.
For the latest updates and call-in times, follow the show on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at CarCast Show. If you'd like to write in, fill out the form on CarCastShow.com. And don't forget to give us a nice rating on iTunes. CarCast is a Corolla Digital production and is produced by Chris Loxamana. For more information, visit CarCastShow.com.
With the Wells Fargo Active Cash Credit Card, you can earn unlimited 2% cash rewards on purchases you want and purchases you need. That means you earn on what you want, like trying out that new workout class, and 2% cash rewards on what you need, like a foam roller for your sore muscles. That's the beauty of the Active Cash Credit Card. It's ready when you are, with unlimited 2% cash rewards. The Wells Fargo Active Cash Credit Card. That's real life ready. Terms apply. Learn more at wellsfargo.com/activecash.